been practically done, and then ask why in the world businessmen would do such things. Some of the motivations behind, which we did a little of last year, too, but for the life of me, it'd be interesting to find out. It'd be.
All right. Well, let me begin by making what I hope to be a short speech. Topic of this session is supposed to be, do businessmen have social responsibilities? Well, you can attribute that, of course, everybody has social responsibilities. But there's been a lot of books and articles written in recent years about business social responsibilities, and they've been written about the social responsibilities of carpenters or clergymen or computer programmers. There is a widespread belief in our society that for some reason, today at least, the businessman in America has some kind of special social responsibility, whether he acknowledges it or not. Why? What might be the nature of these social responsibilities? Well, business is supposed to be very powerful in the United States. And this is a business society. There are a lot of businessmen running very large and powerful corporations. And business may be creating a lot of the social problems that we have today. But even if business isn't creating it, perhaps businessmen can use their power and their resources at their command to resolve some of our pressing social problems. Pollution, partially created by business, maybe partially created by others, that's a problem that a lot of people think businessmen have a special responsibility to resolve. Racism, discrimination against women, even going outside of our boundaries, problems of apartheid in South Africa, General Motors, Gulf, been urged to do something to correct the intolerable situation in South Africa. Well, I'm very skeptical about all of this, but that doesn't mean you have to be. It certainly doesn't mean Dick has to be. It seems to me that there's some fatal confusions, maybe even a lack of nerve involved in the assertion that businessmen have peculiar social responsibility. The lack of nerve is a failure, a refusal to face up to the difficulty of problems and the necessity for our making some sacrifices if we want to resolve the problems. I think that a good deal of the public demand that businessmen be more socially responsible is a demand that problems go away without me having to pay anything. But you can disagree with that. But businessmen, I think, do and indeed ought to respond primarily to the profit and loss considerations that immediately come out of their environment. Put it crudely, I think businessmen ought to try to maximize profits. Why? Because that's something they know how to do. If you're maximizing profits, you're using the resources at your command in an intelligent way. As soon as you try to go beyond this, what are you doing? Well, what is the businessman? If the businessman says, well, this is the product the public seems to want because this is the product that I can produce most profitably. This is the cheapest way to produce it, given all of the things at my command. The businessman says, nonetheless, I won't do this. He's setting himself up as some kind of judge of what the public interest requires, contrary to the dictates of the marketplace. I'm an economist by profession, and maybe I make an idol out of the marketplace. Maybe I think that supply and demand is more godlike than it really is or ought to be. But if that's so, if the businessman ought not to obey supply and demand, if you ought to say, well, the public wants big gas-guzzling automobiles, but I will give them what's good for them, small, gas-conserving, non-chrome-plated, tidy little things. First place, his competitors likely to get all the business. But what he's clearly doing is saying, I am a judge over you, O Israel. Ye shall have what I decide ye shall have. Now, I don't say that the consumer, I think, is often foolish and misled, and he misleads himself. But who is the businessman to play God? That's what bothers me. I believe in the veto of democratic politics over democratic economics. So I think that veto ought to be used sparingly and intelligently. I just don't think that the businessman has any call to set himself up as a social despot. And a benevolent despot, in my way of thinking, is still a despot. And I think that's what the demand for social responsibility finally boils down to. We are asking businessmen to play a godlike role over society, to make decisions in our behalf, to use the resources that society has entrusted to them in ways over which we finally have no control. We're asking them to do things that they have no real incentive to do, and which they have received no clear social directive to do. And then let me take just one concrete example. Let's suppose that a businessman is dumping waste into a stream that flows past his factory. And we say to him, now, you shouldn't do that. You should be socially responsible. Well, he wouldn't be dumping the waste in the stream if it were cheaper to do something else with it. So presumably he's dumping it because, as he looks at it, that's the cheapest thing to do. Now, if we tell him to be socially responsible and stop dumping that waste in, he legitimately raises the question, well, why should I? We'll say, well, because that way you won't pollute the stream for the people downstream. But he says, my pollution, and this is almost always true, my pollution doesn't make that much difference. Everybody else has to stop before it would really make a difference. His action doesn't make other people stop. So what he's doing by not dumping the waste in the stream is incurring a substantial cost for his business without making any significant, any demonstrable, any measurable impact on the quality of the water downstream. And I think he quite rightly said, well, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to destroy or weaken my business without benefiting the people downstream. He should say, this is a political decision. If this river is too polluted because the people along it are using it as a free dump, then it is up to society to alter the system of property rights and charge people to dump into the river or forbid them to dump into the river. But don't expect me to play some godlike role. I don't have the power to clean up the stream by myself, and I don't have the incentive to clean it up. So don't ask me to do it. And he wants to say something before you.
The key to this whole thing, I agree with everything you're saying, but there are some people that might not understand that the key to it is the costing part of it. It is not the profit maximization part of it. If you're going to say that the businessman is bad because he's profit maximizing, that's not true. That's his incentive to be in business. The question is, what are the true costs of doing the business? If somebody wants to cost the polluter of the stream, that is forcing him to pay a penalty to pollute the stream, then he has to determine whether it's profitable for him to continue to pay the cost of polluting the stream and sell his product at a higher price, or whether there is a byproduct of the pollutant that he can make out of it that makes sense. Now, I happen to have grown up in the industrial game in the paper business, which has some strong ramifications. And in Oregon, they tried to force the cleaning up of the lava. And it was kind of funny. Over the long term, some paper companies said, gee, there's some other things we can do. We the company that I worked for landed up making yeast in an area where they never had even thought they could do something like that 10 years ago. But that became a social legislation point first. And once it did, then the business reacted to it. And people, I think, unjustly come after the business world when, in fact, the social world has to establish its objectives first and put a cost on things.
I agree.
All I'm doing is backing what you say.
If we do that, in other words, if we, for example, charge an appropriate price for using the air of the water, then businessmen will behave in a truly socially responsible way, whether they're good guys or not. And I'd like to see that. I don't like
to see that. The one argument to that I have, though, is in the realm of personnel, wherever a factory is, I don't care whether it's in the heart of Harlem or in the heart of Portland or Seattle or Minneapolis, we do have a responsibility to employ minorities to the extent that they're there. At least I believe that we do. If it's there's a 7% minority factor in Minneapolis, we ought to be employing it at that rate.
Well, let's leave that for an open question.
Well, I was going to pick that up as an example. Something that society has decided that the businessman is going to do, and they've legislated that and forced him to do that anyway in the last few years.
Now,
whether he wanted to do it or not, right. And it's made a dramatic change in the way that people are employed. Some companies respond very slowly to that and fight all the way. Others compete like mad, like the company I'm with is Control Data, makes computers, and we're kind of unconsciously competing with IBM to see who can get the higher percentage minorities. They're up around 12 and we're around 9%. And we want to get to 12, but by the time we get to 12, they'll be at 15 or 16. It's a constant race. So sometimes you can get competition working there in between companies. And it's a very real thing. And it's something that we play games with. But it gets me back to the thought I had while you were talking, Paul. Everything we do in business, every move we make, is somehow oriented toward profit maximization, or should be. And I think that's always in the back of our minds. Even guys like me who don't directly influence the profit, I'm not right there in manufacturing and in personnel. And everything we do, though, is thought of in terms of profit. Sometimes it's long-term stuff. Like when we build a plant in the middle of a ghetto to hire people that are on welfare, that are poor, there's still a business motive behind that. And the motive is to try to develop a labor market that's stable. And we were thinking five years out. Our goal was that in 5 years we'd have a stable labor force that was well-trained and had a lot of depth. We had to hire 100 people on a given day, they'd be there and trainable. And it worked out for us. And yet we got a lot of good PR for doing that. Most people probably thought we did it because we were good guys, and that's part of the reason, maybe because some guys had good motives, yet the economic motive was there, really. Because when we were hiring people out in the suburbs, they come and go so fast that you can't keep a stable labor force. So we had a theory that if we moved into an area where people weren't too mobile, like the ghetto, but at least the ghetto that we moved into in North Minneapolis, and we also moved into one in Washington, D.C., found the same thing to be true there, we did develop a very stable labor force. We had to invest some money at the beginning to figure out how to do that, because there were some special techniques that had to be learned in maintaining people, helping people stay on the job, like daycare and legal assistance and things like that, special things. But by and large, that stuff is being paid back now because we have such a high efficiency in the plants. They're right now supposedly our most efficient plants. We've had a lot of attention, and I don't know how much money we've invested in them and what we're getting back in the long run, but we tend to feel that in a 10-year period, we'll well recoup the investment we put into that project. I'm a little off the subject, but still, I'm agreeing with you citing a practical example, that always have that in the back of our mind. You have to have in business, because if you aren't making a profit, you go out of business. We almost went out of business here 2 years ago during the recession, because we had a couple of years where we didn't make profit. But interestingly enough, then the altruistic motives came in. I don't know how long they would have lasted, but we protected that kind of a plant. We put a ring around it and said, we will not lay people off from that plant. If you go into a place like a ghetto, that's one of the things you have to do. You see, that's the last thing you'll do before you go out of business. If you don't do that, it can do you a lot of damage as far as image is concerned. Stockholders don't like that very well, at least some group of them don't. And they make a lot of miserable things happen to you at stockholders' meetings, which for some reason or another, company presidents don't like to be embarrassed in front of stockholders, even if it doesn't hurt them any. You know, there's a lot of pressure there. It's an interesting thing. I don't understand it very well, but I've watched it a few times. Like Honeywell, with all the pressure they took on the war, the bombs, and things like that, that really, really bothered them far beyond the economic ramifications. There were some personal things being said about the guys that run that company. You're bad guys. And, you know, when they come home at night, they've got to face their kids and their wife, I suppose. And it's not nice to have your name in the picture in the paper saying that you're making bombs and kill people, things like that. There's another thought that I had, too, today about how young people tend to influence executives, their children do. There's a phenomenon that's been going on with the guys that I work with. They're all about my age or a little bit older, and that run this company, and their children have been going through this school and through the social responsibility phase. They come home and ask their parents, you know, what are you doing about it? And they feel some great amount of pressure to do something. Almost every guy that I know has got something personal going on his own in the community somehow, besides trying to get the company to do something as well. So there's some personal things that go on amongst executives. The Whirlpool Company in Benton Harbor, Michigan is a good example of that. That's their corporate headquarters. And that, I've only been there once, and I don't understand the city very well, but apparently it was deteriorating. At least they felt it was. And the president of that company decided that they would try to impact that community very heavily by changing it. So he assigned, or he asked each one of the men that worked for him to pick a large community project and head it up on his own outside of the company to get things to happen. I met the man who was involved in daycare. He picked the project of getting daycare projects set up all over town so that people could have a place to leave their children if they wanted to work or just to develop the kids. And he got a system of many, many centers going. He had maybe 1,000 daycare slots because of that effort by this man. It was not directly to impact the company. It was to impact the community that they lived in. Another guy took housing. Another one took transportation. And, you know, somebody ran for the city council so he could get on there and have some influence. And somebody ran for the school board. But they had it was a very carefully planned out, well-coordinated program where they even used some of their own funds, but mostly, you know, manpower and womanpower. And in a 5 or 6 year period, they've had a heck of an impact on that town. That's a philosophy that gets a lot of department stores into social responsibility. At least some that I'm familiar with, they talk about our customers and our employees are the community. Everybody comes through our store at least once or twice a year, so we have to be concerned about that. And that's some of the motivation that gets department store executives out into the community doing things of all kinds, from banking things to daycare things.
You know, if I were the executive officer of a large corporation in a small city like Benton Harbor, and I knew I was going to live there the rest of my life, that's my town, I'd like to live in a pleasant town where people are happy, where the crime rate is low, where the schools are good, where there are nice parks. The town holds together. I've got a pretty strong sense of roots and community, and that I'm sure I'd want to see this. And I would be tempted to divert just as many of the corporation's funds toward the building of this city as I could. And I would do it in the name of social responsibility. And I would talk about sometimes legitimism. I would talk about the necessity of keeping our personnel here, attracting executives. How can we get the good people to come to Benton Harbor if we don't have them make an attractive city, don't have a little chamber music and so on. And I could dress this up endlessly. And some of it would be legit from the standpoint, now let me take the standpoint of the shareholder. You know, it is true. It's hard to get executives to move to the Hicks, to the Sticks. And,
yeah.
But
right.
Well, okay. But there'd be more than that. I'd like to build a pretty town. What I want to point out in this is that isn't clearly socially responsible to do that. There's some point beyond which I am maximizing my own utility at the expense of the shareholders.
You know, it's hard to separate that out, a guy's own personal drive, from what's corporately socially responsible. Bill Torbert just finished doing a study that he told me about last night. He studied the leisure time of executives and blue-collar workers. And the theory that he was, the hypothesis he was dealing from, or something like this, was that blue-collar workers, although they don't get their kicks out of their job, will go out and in their leisure time get their kicks out there, really do something interesting and creative with their leisure time, whereas executives, he wasn't quite sure what they did, I guess. But he found that blue-collar workers tended to do the same thing in their leisure time as they do in on the job, sort of, you know, just sort of not too much creativity either way. And I'm not really sure what he meant by blue-collar workers, I'm just picking that term. But on the other hand, he found that executives who spend a great deal of time on their jobs, you know, maybe 8 to 10 to 12 hours a day, he also utilized their leisure time very creatively. They had less leisure time and they packed a lot more into it. And I suppose, and this isn't what he said, but I can see where a lot of the stuff from the job can slide over into your leisure time. And I think more and more you find guys that are high-ranking executives in a corporation getting into these kinds of things because they're just plain fun to do. There's a need, and you see an impact, you get personal feedback, and it's good instead of bad. And lots of times you're being called bad things, so you kind of feel guilty about some of the things you have to do in business, I suppose. And so that's a way of, you know, expiating your guilt or something like that. There's a lot of interesting things that happen personally. I think in our company that the president, I don't think he feels guilty about it, maybe he does, but he is a very creative guy, and he started out a company 10, 15 years ago that had no employees at all, and now it's a company of over 40,000 employees. And he's done his thing there in business, and he's looking around for other things to do. And he's one of the things he's picked out is the area of social responsibility, and he tends to push us out into that direction. And if we get interested in something personally, he encourages that. Also, that's good executive development experience. Get out into the community and get involved in some very knotty problems, really tough, hard problems, like the one we dealt with this spring in the welfare cutbacks. A lot of the things that we're into are funded by federal funds, at least partially. We've gotten a bunch of things going in the community, and all of a sudden it looked as if they were going to shut down. And it looked like it was going to be a bad thing, like the government was going to ask us, going to set priorities for us that we disagreed with. And here was business, along with a lot of other people in the community, saying, we don't like the standards you're setting for us. I'll use the example of this daycare center that I talk about all the time. We have a daycare center that has 120 kids in it, and it's a place where women that work for us, mostly women, leave their children. They were on welfare, they've gotten off of welfare. Some of them have worked themselves up into some pretty high-level jobs within a manufacturing plant. Some of them are foremen. All of a sudden, they were going to come along and shut the thing down. So we did a study and checked out how many people would not be able to work that were now working, and what the cost, increased cost in welfare was. The local cost for that daycare was $60,000, and the employers were paying that. If the center shut down, the county would have to immediately pay out $100,000 a year in additional welfare costs. It just didn't make sense, because the county was paying zero, and the businessmen were providing the $60,000. They'd have to jump from zero to $100,000 in cost. A lot of people would go back on welfare, and it was just all screwed up. The industry would lose some good employees, no taxes would be paid, so the cost would even be higher. All over the country, that kind of thing happened. And everybody was writing letters. I know that our president wrote to Nixon, I wrote to Weinberger, the head of HEW, and I've talked to people around camp here that have been involved in the thing, and all over that. I think the administration was just absolutely shocked at the way that this thing just popped out. Everybody was screaming about it. And they backed off. They backed off for about a month, and then they said, well, we'll wait till June 30th, and then they said, now we're going to wait till January 1st next year, and it looks like they may just back off altogether, shutting this program down. They hadn't really thought it through. So here was a chance where, you know, talking about society setting priorities for itself and for businessmen, got involved in saying, we like the priorities we've got now, or the standards we've got now for what we're doing, don't change them. Don't make us shut this thing down.
The one thing that does bother me, though, in the whole system is when it comes down to the point where there's some legislation going on to put a cost factor into the business cost. Maybe that means that somebody wants an SST and some other people don't want it. Or maybe that means that we want to clean up rivers and some paper companies don't want it, or we can take it into a number of other industries. I don't understand when it becomes very logical that there's a cost involved that businesses are paying for, where some people take it upon themselves to make what I believe are irrational decisions and pay some lobbyists money to go out and change that. That is, to try to not effect that kind of legislation. That's where I believe the capitalist system falls down, because it's no longer a democracy, it becomes a paid off piece of legislation, negative legislation. And that's the only place where I see the capitalist system falling apart sometimes, or the capitalist economy falling apart.
And also, the capitalist system also influences what our standards are through advertising, as well as lobbying and legislation. I was just thinking when you first started out, Paul, about the tremendous amount of influence that business has on our standards, everything that we do.
Yeah. So would you want to deny business the right to advertise, to lobby, to try to influence public opinion? if you
No, I'd just like to put some ethics into it sometime.
Well, what ethics? That's easy to say. We all want ethics and everything, but where do you draw the line? Yeah. If you're sitting back here, you've got to get Vic's permission to talk to sooner or later. No, just Kate, yeah. Go ahead.
But is this a situation, and you talk about conflict and maximization, you know? Well, does this mean, like, you know, you don't want the businessman being the judge, and yet, you know, like, if you're in the right ethics, like, well, there's an ethical motive, and yet if the dollar is still there, does this still make it ethical?
You're saying that if he's out for profit, he can't be ethical, is that what you're saying?
No, I'm asking that. I mean, is that the way it works?
Well, right now, I guess he's just guided by law. I think that any businessman will go after the dollars as hard as they can until he hits the legal barriers, and sometimes they don't quit there.
And sometimes they stop short because of some personal standard. The guy says, well, that's legal, it might benefit the company, but he says, well, I have a distaste for it. I think a lot of business.
We have a lot of agencies within business itself that try to regulate that thing. We set standards for ourselves in advertising. I don't know if they're good or not, but I know we do have those. And we have in communications with our employers and with our stockholders. There are some, you know, like the Medical Association has ethics, the AMA has ethics. I don't even know if they are.
You know, watch those. Yeah. Those are very often devices to restrict competition.
Yes, they are. And you get right? Some.
Like the doctors don't allow advertising because it would simply raise costs and create more competition. Might even introduce that horrible thing called price competition. Lawyers have similar rules.
Yeah, and there's a great distrust for all that. And maybe business needs an ombudsman to do that. That's interesting. That's one of the things that we're going to do. I'm setting up an ombudsman now just for our employees, but then the next step is going to be one for our customers and our stockholders. And I'm not sure how this would be set up, but it might be a guy completely divorced from the company who has, you know, no axe to grind within, not influenced any way, or anyone could come to and say, you know, this control data is doing a lousy thing here, and we want you to shape up. And the guy can, I don't know what influence he'd have yet, what kind of power, but at least he could come and talk to the board of directors and say, this is really bad, I think. And he'd have to be a guy that they would respect. Lots of businesses are thinking about doing that. We got in so much trouble with the FTC over some of the educational things we were doing that that's the first place we're going to start. We were doing some false advertising, they claim. And I guess that's still in the courts, so I can't talk about it, but at least it's public knowledge that there is a case like that going. But it's bothered us enough so that we will probably have an ombudsman for students that come to our schools and don't like the deal they're getting to complain to. And he'll have the presidency here, and he reacts very quickly to those things. That's just one idea to try to keep things straightened out. I don't know if it'll work or not. And the ombudsman certainly isn't a panacea to everything, but it's an interesting concept.
It seems to me that the consumer has a pretty good ombudsman. He's his own ombudsman. I worry much less. I know this is not true for many of my friends and the people I read, but I worry far less about the way business bilks the consumer than about the way in which government takes advantage of all of us. I'm impressed with the extraordinary range of choices available to the consumer and the amount of information that he can obtain if he's willing to make even a slight effort. Now, I get taken. I buy inferior products, but almost always I get taken because I'm just too lazy to look, or because it's trivial, because the cost of investigating is just too high. I don't know, sometimes I think in this whole area, we like to pick on business, make business the scapegoat as if the worst deceptions are being practiced by business. Oh, I guess my favorite example is this periodic demand that the government establish standards for truth in advertising. Now, who's the government? These regulatory agencies that are lying, the senators and congressmen who run for office and make blatant falsehoods in running for office. If you want to talk about deceptive advertising, take a 30-second commercial during a presidential campaign. They're all deceptive.
Look at what's happening.
Are going to set the standards. In a way, you can't protect people against themselves, finally. If you try to set up an elaborate machinery of regulators to protect people against themselves, then you have Plato's old question. Who's going to regulate the regulators?
This question of consumer protection, I think you mentioned the point where it gets too costly, too time-consuming to get the information as a consumer. I personally feel that's an area where some states, cities, are doing a good job. I know this this business of information, let's say just the thing that's come up recently, meat price control. I was amazed, notice in the supermarket, 42 names for different names for something that were purely meant, in my view, to confuse the buyer. And so you didn't know what you were buying. Now those kinds of things seem to me that it would be so costly to determine what was a better buy that, I don't know if that's a good example, but I think there are areas.
Well, the drug thing, for instance.
Consumer protection has a long way to go. And the reason you don't have it in more places is just because of political power of the business community, and it's more noticeable in local areas, in small towns, than it is in states or in the national level, but it's something that is more of a...
Let me ask you a question. Can I have a question? You start to say something.
Well, I've got something for that area, too. Go ahead.
Oh, I want to ask one question. Why would businessmen resist the effort by local government to establish standards, grades, or just rules that would eliminate clearly deceptive practices? Why would the business community, let's say the supermarkets or the drugstores or whatever industry it is, why would they resist that?
I think that you would resist it because there's an effort to try to get product discrimination. That is, if you call a cut of meat your some name, this is an effort to try to set this product up as something unique to this company. And it would destroy the plain idea that meat companies and meat people for a long time fought federal standards of meat, federal grading choice, good standard, etc. And in fact, it made it impossible for meat companies, slaughter companies, or whatever you might segment of the market, to produce its own branded product, because it now became consumers found that the grades entirely acceptable, and they liked them better than if Swift was going to put its own brand on something.
Well, I'm not clear about the answer. Are you saying that the industry will resist this because they want to use shady distinctions to try to make more money?
I'd say that.
Okay, think that's the same reason you advertise.
All right, but now wait,
get
if that's true. Okay, but see, but if you can do it, if you can do it, so can your competitors.
Yeah.
And if your competitors do it as well as you, then you gain nothing from doing it.
Except that you both make a lot of money.
Well, not necessarily. No.
I think it's entirely possible that you gain nothing from doing it. It's only the consumer that loses.
Okay, right. That's what I suggest, that you gain nothing from doing it. That if everybody is free to do it, nobody gains from doing it.
It depends on your market, yeah. That's all depends on
the market. And now, I don't think that most businessmen are interested in getting going in a little game where you see who can be the most deceptive. I think all businessmen would... Now, the businessmen, sure, are continually tempted to be a little shady in their advertising and product description because they know other guys are doing it, too. And you know, if you take a simple example, if you don't advertise $2 for $1.98, you know, if you say $2 for $2, now that's a simple case of deception. It's one we've all gotten used to, but it is. If I can use the example, $2 for $1.98 is an attempt to deceive. But if you don't do it, your competitors will do it, and you'll lose some toothpaste business to them. Now, what I want to suggest is that if local regulation of deceptive practices were successful in eliminating deceptive practices, and that's all it did, most businessmen in industry would support it.
Well, sure.
What they're afraid of is that when these regulations are written, two things happen. They're written stupidly by people who don't understand the problems of that industry, and they saddle them with all kinds of paperwork and red tape. Another thing they're afraid of is that the regulations will be such that the responsible businessman, the respectable guy can't get around them, but the shady one can. I've investigated enough of these cases to be convinced that that's generally the basis of business opposition, particularly the first one. It is the mindless way in which these regulations get written that bothers most
people. The best way to have that happen is to scare the businessmen with possible regulations, which works very, very well, but, you know, in many cases where they see it coming and they regulate themselves. I sat on the plane next to a woman who ran the American Packaging Association or something like that. We flew from San Francisco to Hawaii, so I had a long time to talk to her. And I got the strategy of that group. This is a group that advises manufacturers on how to package things. And after listening to her for about 4 hours, I came away with just a terribly bad feeling. Their whole philosophy is to be deceptive. Now, that wasn't the way she presented it. It was clever, what she was talking about. But, you know, it's how little a thing you could get into, how big a box, sell it for the size of the box. And this is the person that advises most and develops a strategy for an awful lot of manufacturers and how they package them. But it was just terribly deceptive.
Why is that a problem? I mean, there's nothing deceptive other than someone not taking the trouble to figure out something.
Yeah,
right.
Except that most people don't take that. It was trying to fool you so that even if you began to take a little bit of the trouble to check it out, you
and
still
you think
wouldn't
that's worrying about a trivial problem. I mean, if there's no real deception.
Well, it's wasteful.
And weight or anything.
Well,
like
no,
that.
I don't think it's a trivial problem. I think it's wasteful. If you're
How's
purposely
it
going out to, well,
it's
primarily trying to get people to pay more for something than what it's really worth.
It's waste by consumers' time. I think that's why you've had these laws to put so much cents per ounce in the store. I'd like to find out from Paul. I posed the proposition that further consumer protection agencies was a desirable thing, and I gather from you, you thought it was undesirable. Now, I recognize this fear of agencies messing it up, and we've seen some cases of that kind of thing. But you seem to think that it isn't desirable.
Well, I'm not opposed to the adoption of standards. I think we have all kinds of standards, inches, feet, those are sort of controlled by the government, so that 1 foot means 1 foot and all that. And the government can get involved. And I'm not opposed to the funny thing, I am kind of opposed to that fine choice, because I think that's turned out to be misleading. People really think that. Isn't it true that dietitians say that the prime and the choice are bad for your health? Yeah.
Question. Almost every regulating agency that's ever set up ends up bilking the consumer. I mean, industry ends up controlling that, you know, protecting that industry against the consumer. So why would anybody who's really interested in protecting consumers, you know, ask or, you know, posit that we need more government regulation to protect the consumer? ICC, the Federal Trade Commission. I mean, they're wasting their time taking, you know, companies court and antitrust on relatively trivial matters. You know, in the advertising thing, they get all hung up on, they're really concerned, you know, that the fraud was, you know, ice cream. They were looking at stuff and it wasn't really ice cream, and they couldn't use ice cream because it would melt under the lights. But they weren't really deceiving anybody. And, you know, they were worried that it didn't look exactly like the texture of the real ice cream. Now, this is not.
Well, I'm not so sure about that statement. I have a difficult time accepting the fact that some of these regulatory agencies aren't being effective. They may not have been in the past, but the FTC, for instance, in the last year, has scared the heck out of an awful lot of people and made them change their practices in a broad scope.
Yeah, I'm talking about the long run in general.
Yeah, maybe so.
Short term, and also, I don't know, and even in short term, the FTC, I mean, it might appear to be
They scare the heck out of a lot of people, but I could run around in the dark at 10 o'clock and scare the heck out of a lot of people who would change their behavior.
Well, let me say one other thing.
But I agree very much with Don that they go after some of the most trivial cases. They choose cases on the basis of can they win and get maximum public
and get exposure. Like they're doing something. The other quick example is the thing. Remember the old shaving commercial with sandpaper thing? They made a big deal out of that and got that taken off. And that was really not much of a deception. I mean, that again had...
Well, I'm not talking about those so much as they go after...
That's an example.
They've had some pretty big cases where they've actually forced companies into changing their entire behavior. They forced us into doing some fantastically different things than we used to.
It made your performance significantly better.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a huge set of schools all over the world that have been really changed. The way that we select our salesmen, we've thrown out all the salesmen we had and brought in a different kind of guy. We had a pot and pan salesman, we used to call him. You know, and he would sell anybody anything, regardless of what it was. And then he'd run off and he'd get a commission and that's all he cared about. And half the people who would come in and would fail. And that's what we got caught on, I suppose. We've changed our entire approach to that, spent an awful lot of money, and turned it all around. Very careful.
Paul?
So I'm speaking of a personal experience where I watched this happen.
But before we leave this, I agree with Don. We may both be wrong. That if you look at the record, the Federal Regulatory Agency, the Interstate Commerce Commission, the granddaddy of all, the FTC, which I think the FTC and the Antitrust Division both are in a business. I think, we used to say that these agencies regulate in the interest of the consumer. Then we got more sophisticated and recognized, that they tend to be captured by the industry and regulate in the interest of the industry. But I think the truth is they regulate in the interest of the regulatory commission. So the FTC regulates largely in such a way as to maximize its congressional appropriations in the next session.
That's right. That's what it's all about. That's what it's all about.
I'm going to lose those jobs.
Yeah. The FDA makes a big
thing. I think maybe the only reason the FTC is doing something is because of the individual who's running it right now. He happens to have a couple of axes to grind that have done some constructions.
Extraordinary, powerful individuals who can buy caprice.
And I think the thing that's important, did you have something?
No, go ahead. I think he wants to get on.
The thing that's important here, we're going through government reorganization in South Dakota, and you'd be surprised the stories you hear when you are trying to go from 165 different governmental organizations down to 16. You know, everybody all of a sudden find very many reasons of why they're very, very important. And, you know, I'm not so sure that they're coming in there trying to kid anybody. That gets, you know, if we started to decide here that we didn't need the kind of job you do, you know, you start to, it's just human nature. It's kind of like needing bread and butter, you know, and water. You start thinking of some awfully good reasons why you have to exist. And then you have to try to sort through, you know, what's a bunch of baloney and what's factual, and it's pretty heavy. So, you know, we're talking about human nature here as well.
Well, that's just a problem, you know, human nature. Like Paul, you haven't protected what's going on.
Sorry to...
Yeah. I want to change the subject a little bit. You know, like you're saying that, you know, if we want businesses to behave in a socially responsible way, what we should do is just pass laws to make everybody do what we think they should instead of just expecting somebody to do it on their own and hurt the company and all that. But isn't one of the things... a businessman could do, or the businesses could do, is to just, you know, suggest, you know, they have maybe a pretty good idea of what kinds of laws would work, you know, to help things, you know, especially on the specific things, you know, think about environment or something. I mean, I suppose businessmen could help a lot in writing the laws on that. Why don't businesses, I think maybe they have a responsibility to push for laws.
They do.
They do.
They certainly do. It's obvious they're now writing laws left and right.
Yeah, but I mean, I just have never heard of any businesses going lobbying for pollution control bills.
Sure.
They get extremely cooperative and are really a source of information.
And they're often suspected. That's the trouble. Yeah. You know, a business could be, you know, the businessman could be St. Francis himself in there lobbying for what he thinks is really a good environmental protection law. And chances are that because he's a businessman and is lobbying for it, a lot of people will discount that.
Or somebody from his industry will counteract a piece of piece of testimony, all of a sudden the whole thing out is an industrial squabble.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then but you always get back and you can write a perfect law, you know, we've got 10 of them. But that doesn't mean anything, because when you form the agency to go ahead and carry the thing out, then you get back to human beings again. And you get all screwed up when they start writing out the booklets of regulations about how you carry out this little 300-word law. Talking about human beings.
And you get into the area where business and government get together and everybody distrusts what they're doing. I've seen a lot of that happen lately, where and then you get a lot of protest groups out. Like there was a fellow here last year named Raleigh Comstock who was involved with environmental stuff in the local power company. That was one of the most fascinating things. He had a slide presentation. Did you see that, Paul? 2 years ago, he had gone through all the history of the newspaper accounts of everything that went on over a 2-year period, and how his company got involved with the government, and the government would say they're going to do something, and then they just about did it. Some private group would come along and raise all kinds of difference with both of them, and then the government would back off and change his mind, and NSP would have to back off. And they started to stop, postpone the building of a power plant for a long, long time, 4 or 5 years, until finally the company just threw up its hands and said, "You guys tell us what to do, and we'll do it." Really, to everybody's detriment of everybody in society.
Oh, and then when they started this new one, the Cookie and Dale were fighting all in it. The reason they could not start planning a nuclear one right away, which is much less pollution, was because they didn't have time to go through the court hassles that it would take to build a nuclear plant. So they just
haven't they developed a policy now that they're only going to build fossil fuel plants now? Mm-hmm. The most polluting things in the world, these fossil fuel plants. And they were trying to build nuclear power plants and just can't do it. The public won't let them. And so they're going to go to fossil fuel plants and burn coal and belch out smoke. I don't understand that. The people, that the environmentalists that are complaining about all this pollution and smoke end up being promoting the building of plants that belch out smoke.
Yeah, but Grant Merritt, who is the government guy fighting that, is the one that is stirring up the most.
Yeah, he's got some hidden agenda there too, I think. His own career, I suppose, a few other things that enter into it. It used to be awfully complex. Especially when I was on a task force that Raleigh was on too, in the county that we live in, trying to figure out how we can get government and industry to work together to solve social problems. And Raleigh was in the first year, and I was in this last year. I was on the follow-up task force. The first year just came to the decision that it was a good idea for government and industry to try to work together. And it took them a whole year to figure that out. But what they were really doing is getting over this fear of each other. And they finally decided that there's nothing to be afraid of, and they had a whole list of reasons why, and a whole list of things that you can do together. And everybody bought it, at least on these task force, and we supposedly represented everybody. And then our charter was to take that and find and get some things to happen. And the idea was to get the enormous resources that business has in managing things and technical and all this, and their money to come to bear on some of the social welfare problems. So the first thing that the county did was come to a bunch of businesses and say, "Why don't you take over our detoxification centers?" And they expected everybody to come rushing in and want to do it. And no one would touch it. They said, "Absolutely not. We won't have a thing to do with you." And so then they tried something else, and the businessmen just wouldn't bite. And so we sat around trying to figure out what was going on, why not. And I came to the conclusion it was just all the red tape involved in dealing with the county and all the risks involved in performance contracts. The performance contracts are very difficult to make. And so even when you make a sincere attempt to get industry involved in social affairs on a profit-making basis, which this was, everybody finally decided it was okay for business to make a profit trying to solve welfare problems. The reason they solved that, by the way, is because the county had absolutely failed trying to solve their own problems, and so this was another solution they were looking for, and they were willing to pay a little price for it. But businessmen wouldn't bite. So it hasn't worked out at all. That's another way of trying to get businesses to be socially responsible, is to get them into the, and to do some of the things they can do well in that arena, like providing jobs, running a system, manage facilities, and pay them a profit.
Well, I think that's a good idea.
But when you get into that, you find all kinds of little things that hang on that are going to cost you money that you can't plan on, that you don't plan on.
Is that largely because they're surrounded by a lot of regulation?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And unwritten regulation. I got caught last year in December when in this daycare center that 8 companies run in town, all of a sudden we discovered that there was an unwritten regulation that the county was enforcing that ended up costing us $10,000 or $15,000. And
what do you mean, yeah, unwritten?
Well, an accountant came up and we came up $10,000-$15,000 short. And I said, how come? He said, well, there's this new little thing here that we've got that figures out the per diem rate on how long we pay for the kids you got. Well, that's not in our contract. Well, but that's part of the deal. So you never told us about that before. Oh, I thought we had. Well, we didn't. It wasn't written down in the contracts.
Well,
it was such
practice.
Very loose. See, well, he just made it up 3 months before and hadn't told anyone. So we have a very difficult line of appeal. And we did. We appealed to the county commissioners and to the head guy and got no further. So we finally went back to a friend of mine who was running the purchase and service thing and we got him. We said, we're going to quit this whole business if you don't do something. We just threatened to back out. So he managed to forward the $15,000 into the next year, so we made it up in the first 3 months. But it was an awful manipulation, wasted a lot of time. It's kind of hard to believe, but there's a lot of unwritten rules floating around that people aren't aware of.
You can't make them buy. I mean, that's because there's so much regulation. Which
yeah,
sort of goes back to what we were talking about.
Yeah,
before.
So what you head for is writing a contract that you write down every single little possible condition that ever come up, and you say, oh, the heck with it, that's too much work. You know? That's where it falls apart. There's no trust. I think maybe there's a thing there where businessmen trust each other more than they would. There's trust between the government and business, or even within the government agencies.
We've run into some of that with our group one here at the village, and that's sort of an interesting thing. One thing we've had sort of fun with is the fact that if you do something positive as far as government is concerned, like the Forest Service or the Health Department, they'll come in and see that and praise you for it, and the next year it'll be their law, and they'll expand on it. Like one of the funniest things was, well, I don't know if it's so funny, but it did occur on Lodge 6 over here. We put a handrail on for Dave Helm. And because he does a lot of woodworking in the shop, he needed a handrail to help him get up the stairs. Well, the state health inspectors came in, and right away they said, well, you don't have a handrail on the other side, so by August 26th, you have to have one on the other side. For all these years, we've never had one on either side.
That just drives you crazy.
When we set it up with the county on this group home, we specifically told them we're not going to write any reports. No, if we get stuck in that, we're going to quit, because we just won't get caught in it. And little by little, you know, they try to cause you to do these things. But some of the ridiculous regulations they have on these things, such as over in Lodge 6 again, where we have the boy, they require that the water is no more than 132 degrees or something like that. Well, you know, this is all right if you're dealing with three-year-olds and four-year-olds that might burn themselves in a hot water faucet, but here we're dealing with guys that are 17, 18 years old. And you're not going to burn yourself on even 150 degree water, you know. But it's a regulation that they have in the statutes for the group home.
Have you run into conflicting regulations?
No.
Where one group,
yeah, well,
one guy will say, you do
that,
this, and the other guy
yeah.
says, no, you do this, and
yeah.
they don't match. I run into that all the time.
Yeah.
I remember.
The other thing within this state now, for the group home, the state health department inspects. For the rest of the village, the county health department inspects, and they don't honor each other's inspections.
Yeah. There just seems to be an endless number of inspectors wandering through social projects or projects.
Well, not only social projects, but all building
yeah.
projects.
Yeah. Well, in an industry, this ocean.
If you want to go to first dinner, that was the bell. If you don't, you want to go to second setting, I'm going to sit around while talking about you.
Sure, I'm going to second setting.
I've got to leave at 5:20 and do dishes. My crew is over. And our left, she's my crew number one. That's the best crew there is.
There she goes. There she goes.
You got dishes tonight.
You mentioned apartheid when you first started out. We have a plant in South Africa, and spent a lot of time trying to figure out what to do, what to pull out. I'm sure not. That's one of the most soul-searching, difficult decisions to make. One of my contemporaries went down there, spent a month trying to shape up or size up the situation, decide whether or not we should pull out or stay in there or what. And found a rather surprising thing. It's hard to describe it, but we discovered that the South African government will let a business do anything it wants to do as long as it doesn't raise public opinion against it. It was a rather surprising thing. The government, in fact, wants businesses to be the moving force in improving the employment lot of the colored and the Indian, or I guess Indian and colored, and the black, up to a point. And as far as, in fact, you can go as far as you want to. And part of that's because the young people in South Africa are really unhappy about it. Most of them apparently are very unhappy about the way things are and they want to change it. And the present government recognizes the fact that they're going to be voting and having a bigger influence as time goes by, so that the young people are putting the pressure on there. So we were allowed to do a lot of things. We have some black customer engineers going on to projects like Atomic Energy Commission projects. The only problem is that if we want to move a black engineer into a plant that's run by the government or some other agency, some other company, everybody on that in that area, in that plant, has to vote yes for that guy to come in. If one man blackballs him, he can't come in. So that makes it very hard for us to do any affirmative action type of thing. But we've set a goal for our country manager there, a very, very stringent, hard goal in terms of their environment, to increase his black headcount and get people voted up. And if we do what we plan to do this year, we're going to do some surprising things. We thought we were really leading the pack, and we checked around and found out that General Motors and IBM and all of them had done the same thing. They discovered it independently from each other. So now we form kind of a loose association where we're checking out with each other how we're doing. But then the South African government has this policy of eventually wanting to move all blacks back to, I forget what they call them, but they're like reservations. They move them all back to where they came from. Some term. Yeah, and so eventually in the 10-year period, the blacks that are now congregated around Johannesburg and places like that will be back in out into the sticks where they originally came from. They're going to divide them up by tribes. One of the problems that the South African government says it has is the fighting between the tribes that are all jammed together in these ghettos around the towns. They fight and kill each other, and they have all kinds of internecine warfare. And they want to split these people out and shove them back out to their own villages, so they won't do this. They use that as an excuse. So it's really a confusing situation. Because on the one hand, we're trying to employ more blacks in the metropolitan areas, and on the other hand, we're trying to ship them all back out into the woods. And I don't know where it's going to end up. But most companies have decided to stay using the rationale that their presence can influence the culture and the environment toward a more positive thing. Here's a case where business is putting moral values into the situation, saying that promoting blacks is good, you know, and things like that. In the face of a general societal moral condition, says that's not good, that's not the way we want it. And we've done some special things for our employees too. We've gone out of our way to make sure that that the black employees that work for us, their children get the same kind of education that the white employees do. They have to be separate, but at least they're going to get that education. This is something that they were not getting. So we've developed some benefits too that are sort of discriminatory in the opposite direction. We discriminate more toward the colors and the blacks, and making sure that they do get benefits like education for their children. That requires stipends for children's educations in private schools for black people that we do not give to white people in South Africa. And surprisingly enough, the white employees we have there are all for that. They think that's a heck of a good idea. That's what I'm told anyway. Haven't been there yet, so I don't know.
These corporations, U.S. corporations involved, particularly in South Africa, but in some other overseas operations too, those cases in particular frustrating to me because of some things that I just can't reconcile with any kind of common sense. For example, the demand of campaign GM, that GM pull out of South Africa. You start asking that. Now, these are intelligent people. Several churches were prominently involved in that, the Presbyterian Church chiefly. They voted their whole ownership in GM and campaign vigorously. Had some bishops who worked on it.
not just a little elementary, now surely these men are intelligent and know that GM, how can GM pull out of South Africa? What does that mean? Doesn't mean to simply turn over the ownership of the plant to the South African government.
And they can run it just well, as well as anyone else. It doesn't work that way.
Whom are you trying to benefit here?
They maybe picture them loading everything onto a boat and bringing it back home. Well, that's not going to happen.
Another question that I've raised this with some people in the Project for Corporate Responsibility, Nader's groups and so on. They're asking American corporations to intervene in U.S. foreign policy at times. Do we want American corporations intervening in foreign policy?
Or vice versa, do American corporations want to?
A lot of people assume, I think incorrectly, that American corporations would love to make foreign policy. Well, even if, whether that's true or false, I don't want American corporations involved in foreign policy. And, you know, it's really against the law. Very wise law. American citizens or corporations are not supposed to engage in foreign policy.
We get highly criticized for all kinds of things. Every country that we deal with around the world, we have something wrong with it. Somebody finds something wrong with it. We shouldn't be in Germany because they started World War II or something like that, some wild thing. Or we shouldn't be dealing with the Eastern Bloc countries because they are communist and that's bad, evil. And so our posture, our policy has become, we abide by the policy of the federal government. If they say it's okay for us to do business with Romania, then we'll do business with Romania. And I'm not so sure that's a good policy. We've got lots of good arguments against that, but at least that's the policy we've taken right now. Then we keep playing with that, like in South Africa. We try to change that and make it a little bit better. Running into all kinds of problems, social responsibility problems, because of, with our own employees, because we're dealing with Russia, China, all of the Eastern Bloc countries, someone may be very concerned that we sold a large computer to the Polish Atomic Energy Commission. You know, that's possibility of helping them develop bombs and things like that. And yet our government says that's all right, you go ahead and do that. But we get an awful lot of flack from stockholders about that.
Back to this consumer protection, just one point. I fully agree with the problems of regulation, what's happening in the ICC and so forth. You dare say I agree with these things. But I think what I was referring to was much the elimination of laws created on local and state level for the benefit of businessmen, and that these consumer protection agencies are just eliminating things which were laws created to enhance profit. Competitive restrictions, eliminating, or this would, what I'm thinking of is really the elimination of anti-competitive rules and regulations that have been set up. Things that have been set up to allow price fixing on the state level.
You just replace a law by a bunch of regulations. Because all these agencies promulgate all kind of regulations themselves.
Then it just involves getting law books that allow us these price fixing. Not anti-competitive practices.
We can at least remember that the overwhelming thrust of state and local government when it intervenes in business is to help businessmen eliminate competition. Tremendous number of laws are drafted. We're going to establish regulatory agencies.
We could stand some counterbalancing on the other side in favor of consumers in our state and local governments, as opposed to what has been going on in the past.
Well, let's take an example. It's one I'd like to get some opinion on here, where some people have said the consumer interest is being sabotaged by the automobile industry. The whole question of automobile safety, particularly the mandatory seat belts and the airbag. How do you people feel about it? It looks like the way Congress is feeling on it, we're coming to the age where you will you know, I think it's like if you don't have your seatbelt and your harness belt fastened, your automobile will blow up, killing you instantly. Well, no, they are moving that.
They're not going to move.
Yeah, now that, well, now, apparently there's a majority sentiment in many state legislatures for $25 fine.
Yeah, make it a criminal penalty.
Yeah.
Go ahead and pass it.
Yeah. Now, is this the, Ralph Nader speaks very highly of this, and his name is sort of identified with consumer protection. I think something's gone amok here.
Yeah, we're reminded that having lost sight of our goal, we redouble our efforts. You know,
yeah. Exactly. Maybe we'll find it.
From a social cost standpoint, it's still possible, I don't know. There's some point where the costs of accidents, the cost of regulation equals the cost of
and that happens very quickly, I submit. And the government gets, I mean, the cost, both tax dollars for the government regulating and being involved, plus businesses getting around it, just like you're talking, you get all these regulations, you don't know what the hell to do, you may do nothing, which is bad maybe, or your legal costs, you can't move, you don't know what to do. Yeah. Or they just, it gets passed on to consumer anyhow, one way or the other, has to.
Can I take a poll? How many of you would favor a law, say, if you don't have your, all cars, let's assume that all cars now have to have shoulder harnesses and seatbelts, and how many of you would favor a law, say, imposing a $25 fine on a person for driving a car without his harness?
Would oppose it?
How many of you would favor such a law? The only one?
I think if it just affected yourself, then it's your own choice whether or not you want to do it. But if there's a chance of affecting other people in accidents,
but that's brakes.
That's not
seatbelt. Yeah, there's several reasons for opposing it. First of all, it's not going to work because it isn't going to achieve any goal, even of getting people to use their seatbelts.
You think a $25 fine?
Well, no, the fact that I'm not worried about being caught.
It's hard to enforce that.
You see,
the harness is pretty visible.
Yeah, but I could fake that. I could fake that, I suppose, if I wanted to.
Yeah, but you're going to take the thing and lay it across your.
I know lots of people. I know lots of people that are going to much further, much further lengths. They knot these things up and tie them around and hook coat hangers around to make sure that they don't turn on the buzzer. They go. It takes a half hour to do some of those crazy things.
Why are you people in favor?
Hasn't it been proved fairly well statistically that you are safer in a crash if you have a seatbelt and a shoulder harness fastened?
It's also been demonstrated statistically that you're safer not crossing the street than you are crossing the street. So you should therefore not cross the street.
Well, but if you're going to drive in a car, you already accept the fact that you have a chance of being in an accident. I mean, okay, so you're going to be driving and there's a chance.
Yeah, but question, why do you impose that standard on me? You can wear your seatbelt. I don't want
because
a law
if you get if you get in an accident and you're not wearing a seatbelt, I'm going to sometime have to pay the medical bills for you.
How so?
And your kids will.
Insurance.
How so?
Insurance.
Society.
We'll let you mean,
sure.
You're going to pass a law, I got to wear a seatbelt because if I hurt myself, you might have to pay my kids' welfare. Is that true?
Yeah, and our insurance.
Of course, your insurance. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Yes.
You can find some economic justification.
Sure. It's expensive to the taxpayer because.
That's the thing we're talking about with Christianity, isn't it, of taking care of each other?
I tend to take. The neatest thing you do is leave people alone.
Do you really feel that way?
Yeah, I want to be free to decide whether I want to wear a seatbelt.
Really,
yeah. I mean, I think you can tell me not to have, it's your problem if I don't have brakes, but not a seatbelt.
Where does this lead to?
I think you've got a much bigger problem with automobiles besides the seatbelt.
Yeah, right.
There's a whole big hassle here about having to go to low lead gasoline, and a whole big hassle about anti-pollution devices on the automobile. The American public screamed their head off and said, yeah, man, you big bad industry, you got to have low lead gas, which they did not buy. You got to have anti-pollution devices all over the car. And then they smile and say, hey, this is great, we got no pollution, but we're burning up gasoline at about 4
yeah, right, around 8 miles a gallon more.
And the American people is completely apparently naive to this. One of these days they're going to wake up, and they're going to say, holy cow, You can't have pure air. You've got you can have clean air, but you can't have pure air. And you've got to make up your mind where that line is. How much are you willing to give in order to have clean air before you get to the ridiculous thing of insisting that you're trying to get pure air, which you can't have?
Yeah, and I think that applies directly to what you were saying. How much of his freedom and freedom of the rest of us are you willing take away in order to protect yourself against what probability of having to pay welfare to his children? Yeah. If you start that notion that we are all, that we cannot allow anyone in this room to take, would you pass a law against people trying to scale El Capitan in Yosemite or mountain climbing? Every week you read about people killed and injured. I think that makes a lot more sense. I think it would make sense for society at least to say, if anybody falls in a crevasse of being up on a glacier where he has no business being, he doesn't get rescued. But we don't do that.
Yeah, where do you draw the line? You end up pretty soon. You know, seatbelt's pretty trivial. I mean, that statistic's pretty marginal, you know, I think.
I'm not sure that it is.
No,
it's not drastic.
I don't think we're arguing the point of whether a seatbelt has merit or not. I thought we started out discussing a mandatory law.
Well, but on the basis that
I would be opposed to the law, for example, of a $24 fine, but I use a seatbelt every time I get in an automobile.
Sure, right. So I just don't want you deciding that. Yeah. The point is you're doing it on a grant, on whether or not it has merit. Right? It has so much merit that you're willing to fine me if I don't wear it. Maybe I don't like that.
I think more to the point are safety devices that would affect other people in accidents.
Yeah, sure.
And
no one can pull off with those. Yeah, right. Brakes. That's different.
Yeah,
that only affects me.
You're going to do something that's unsafe that affects me, then I would probably
I'd be willing to fine somebody $100 if they would violate a universal bumper height standard.
Yeah.
And that one would make me pretty happy.
Right.
And I don't think I'd get an argument from anybody in the room against the law requiring standardized bumper heights.
Well, one reason I brought it up is because I think it's fascinating. People get quite excited arguing about it. But also because it's another thing that puzzles me. I'm convinced that the automobile is the greatest disaster to befall the human race in the 20th century. And I'm intrigued by the way in which, instead of dealing with the problem of the automobile, we piddle around with converters, transformers, seat belts.
Because we'll do it in pennies. We'll spend pennies all day long, or dollars, but millions of dollars to solve a transportation problem. Nobody wants to identify themselves with that particular answer.